Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, a Brussels-based economic think tank. We are going to talk today about decarbonization and how to get buildings to play their role in the climate transition. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, joined today by Bruegel's Giovanni Scaravatti, who has written a paper with colleagues about ways to do this and recommendations to do it better. And to give us context and anchor us in how this is working, we have Michael Pala from the Potsdam Institute and Marion Santini from the Regulatory Assistance Project, who know lots and lots about this and are going to help us work through it. So Giovanni, tell us about your paper and about the EU's initiative to renovate buildings, make them more energy efficient, and do it in a way that doesn't break the bank.
Well, thank you so much. So this is a paper I wrote with colleagues Ugne Kaliuskaite, Ben McWilliams, and Simone Tagliapietra. And we decided to write the paper because the European Union just adopted a new directive on the topic, the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive, also called the EPBD. And we have also seen some case studies of policies in a bunch of member countries in the EU that, you know, went well in some instances and in some others a bit less. So we decided to look into the topic and really dive in. We estimated how much is the investment gap to meet the EPBD energy consumption targets by 2030. And we are talking about 153 billion per year at the EU level for both residential and non-residential buildings. So it's a considerable amount of money. We are talking about more or less 1% of EU GDP. However, the good news is that both thanks to the RRF and later on, thanks to the ETS2, there is going to be a substantial amount of revenues that can be used to improve the energy renovations, the pace at which they happen.
Michael, how big a deal is this directive and where will it take us?
Originally, it was planned as a much bigger directive. The Energy Performance on Buildings Directive included minimum energy performance standards for a lot of buildings in the EU. And if they had been mandatory, they would have driven renovation substantially. But in the course of negotiations, they were watered down substantially. And I think in terms of being a lever for decarbonization, that leaves us with a little bit more to do using other tools. And so this is where the emission trading system comes in. And this is an alternative pathway, alternative tool to incentivize renovations. And there will be correspondingly now there needs to be a higher role for using this tool, given that the Energy Performance for Buildings Directive has been watered down with respect to the standards.
So the emissions trading system, we're more familiar with that in terms of big manufacturers. How does this scale to individual households?
Yeah, this is a second mechanism that is going to be effective 100% really from 2027. While the ETS, so let's say that the first one applies to the power sector and, as you said, to big manufacturers, so energy intensive industry, this one instead is going to touch buildings and the transport sector and a small part of the remaining manufacturing sector. The point of regulation is really at the suppliers level. However, everyone, well, the analysts really expect an almost 100% pass-through to consumers who are going to find it in their own energy bills. Now, the instrument is great to recalibrate, especially relative prices between electricity and natural gas or oil, etc., especially, you know, for this context of buildings heating, because at the moment, while electricity indeed is subject to the ETS, gas and other fossil fuels are not. So the ETS2 will help rebalance this relation. However, what Dr. Pale, for example, among others such as Agora have flagged is that if we rely too much on this price mechanism, the impact could be quite significant for households and small companies. So yeah, it was fascinating to read the paper, Carbon Prices on the Rise, shedding light on the emerging EU ETS2. Maybe Dr. Pali can tell us a bit more about it. But yeah, what we also find in the paper is trying to translate the prices that they flag in the paper into higher energy bills. And we find that if the ETS2 price goes above 150 euros per ton of CO2, then we are really talking about an impact as big as during the energy crisis of 2022. In the paper, Pale and co-authors, they have prices even higher than that if policymakers don't really speed up energy efficiency investments in buildings, but rely only on this new pricing mechanism.
That's a big shock to individual households. Marion, tell us about your group, what you do, and then how you fit into this issue and what you're recommending.
Sure. So I work for the Regulatory Assistance Project. We are a nonprofit organization. We provide support to decision makers that are facing very tough decisions when it comes to planning for the energy transition. So we provide support to them in order to design policies that work well for everyone. And we pay particular attention to equity issues. And what I would like to bring to the discussion today, I think that Giovanni, you started to mention that the ETS might have a large impact on some households. So basically what happens is that when the price of energy goes up, there would be two types of reactions. So either you have the possibility to hedge yourself against the price increase and you have the possibility to make an investment which will protect you from the price increase, or you don't have this possibility and then you will be in a position where you have to reduce the amount of services that you are using. Now, what's happening in the EU is that many people already today, before the ETS is introduced, so many people already have little access to energy services. And what is very important today, and it's important, it's urgent, is that we are in a position to support those people, make the right investment in order to protect themselves against future energy price variation. May they come from the ETS or from other price shocks on energy markets, like the ones we've seen in the past couple of years.
So, Michael, Giovanni just mentioned your paper talking about the impact that this will have. Can you walk us through what you found?
Yeah, so what we did is we analyzed how prices might evolve going forward, depending on how much complementary policies will be implemented and how effective they will be. And the economic intuition is quite straightforward. The more complementary policies we have that can already induce decarbonization in the building sector, the lower the demand for allowances in the new system and the lower the price. So there's a clear interaction effect between the ETS and other policies. And that's our main finding. And in light of that, Giovanni and colleagues make the case that we need to strike the right balance to have these other policies and the ETS price because of the political and economic challenges that come with very high allowance prices. And the price could go up to some 250 plus euros, which is quite a lot, especially when compared with the price effect of the energy crisis and distributional equity problems that Marion already pointed out. So that is the main finding. But it brings us back to the question of how to strike the right balance and how to consider the equity issues in that equation. And I think this is where the paper makes a lot of interesting contributions and suggestions. And this is what we need to look at. I think that's the main discussion at stake. It's actually bigger than the building sector. This is also something I want to amplify, because when there will be pushback against this instrument, there will be pushback against ETS, and one of the main, if not the most important instrument at the EU climate policy framework. So we might see a reaction that is maybe to some extent normal. It means a moderation of ambition, but it could also substantially undermine the trust in the market and the role of, and then thus the effectiveness of the market. So this is something we definitely need to concern about. It's not only about prices being too high and political problems, but it could lead to a substantial backlash and an adjustment of the whole system that might be very counterproductive in the long run.
Thanks for that. Marion, I want to come back to this issue of equity. Can you walk us through just how to think about this? It seems to me we have buildings that are inefficient and old and heavily dependent on fossil fuels, and we have a desire to renovate them to switch to cleaner sources of energy. And we also have very limited national budgets. And so it's almost like in some circumstances, we could be asking individual households to bear the financial burden of making kind of the broader world a better place, which is something that we tend to associate with governments and with big groups. How do we get into that? How do we approach it? And what are the constraints here?
I think on that point, it's quite interesting to see that the Fit for 55 package, which is the package that the EU just adopted to revamp its climate policies, takes quite a different view on these issues than what has been done in the past. So when the package was released, the Commission made it very clear that pricing instruments like the emission trading schemes would only work well if there are some other policies that would actually make people make the investments into the energy transition. So there was this recognition from the start that this is very important. And throughout the negotiation, it has become very clear that it is very important to make sure that you actually dedicate a certain amount of funding, a certain amount of energy savings to those who need it most. And for the first time, the EED and the EPBD, which is the Buildings Directive, so the Efficiency Directive and the Buildings Directive, recognize this need for really ring fencing, keeping a part of the pot for those who need it most. I think this is making a big difference because we know that when you don't think about those groups when designing policies, then those groups don't benefit from the policies. And so I think now with the package that the EU has just adopted, we have a different vision on this issue.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll get deeper into the recommendations. Giovanni, what did you put forward as ways to tackle this? Your paper covered everything from finance to construction to regulatory coordination. Walk us through your recommendations.
Super. So basically, we have a bunch of policy proposals that we think could help tackling this massive issue. So the first one links very well with what Marion was saying before. It's important to front-load the investment towards the vulnerable consumers. Also to limit the compensation spending later, because as we said before, if the ETS2 price goes as high as what Dr. Pale was referring to, then the risk is really that these households will be affected dramatically. And we could see a similar dynamic as what we saw during the energy crisis, when EU governments earmarked about 540 billion euros in less than 2 years, that just to shield households and small companies. So vulnerable consumers are in most instances those who live in worst performing buildings, which are the buildings where you can get the biggest bang for the buck, really. So where your investment, your euros spent on renovations have the most effect in lowering emissions, energy consumption. For example, we calculated that the 10% of worst performing buildings in the EU, renovating them could lower emissions by 20% and therefore lower ETS2 emissions, the overall ETS2 emissions for the period by 8%. This is going to have a downward pressure on prices. So it's important to target the public money towards worst performing buildings, and you're going to have the double dividend of social and climate benefits. The second thing we recommend is really to do a bit more to change relative prices. At the moment, electricity retail prices for households, for example, are four times as expensive as retail gas prices in Germany. We are talking about 42 cents per kilowatt hour versus 11. And so even if a household buys a heat pump, which is generally three times more energy efficient than a gas boiler, then if the price is still four times as much, the household, the investment case is still not there, right? So the relative prices need to change. To do that, well, the energy taxation directive should really be looked into again, which is now currently its recast is frozen on the shelf. The fossil fuel subsidies should really be phased out as soon as possible. And then we have a bunch of other recommendations in the paper as well. As Marion was mentioning, it's super important to leverage future energy savings. We did the computations and we are talking about potential energy savings that are as big, well, half as big as the investment gap. So basically, you could close half of the investment gap already by just using the energy savings into the future to reduce the upfront cost for renovations. Now, there are a bunch of policies that help doing that. Some are, you know, the energy service agreements on bill finance, by which, you know, households pay on the energy bill the renovations. So basically, they keep paying the same energy bills as in the past. But after the renovation, given that the energy consumed is going to be much less, then the difference is going to go to finance the renovation. Energy performance contracts. Then also, we can think of energy saving feed-in tariffs. So to use the same instrument that was used for renewables deployment to support energy efficiency, energy savings. And then we can think also of more obligation type of policies, energy efficient mortgages, energy efficiency obligations, mortgage portfolio standards, which are also into the EPBD, property taxation, etc. We list a bunch of these policies in the paper. And finally, the other two points. One is involve banks. That is really important. As you said before, the governments cannot do it all by themselves. The gap is too big, and there are a bunch of fiscal also considerations to take into account, especially after the new rules that were agreed. So it's important to bring in the private sector and to involve banks. There are some case studies like the zero interest loan in France or involving public development banks like in Germany. So the examples are there. The problem is that they are still limited in terms of volume of funding and dwellings tackled. So they need to be scaled up. And then finally, we talk about one-stop shops. These are very important to reduce the administrative burden of consumers because they go to just one body that is going to help with everything from finding the workers for the constructions, helping with the mortgage at the bank, et cetera. So I think, you know, this portfolio, unfortunately, there is no silver bullet. So we really need a portfolio of instruments. But I think with all of that, we can definitely meet the targets in the EPBD by 2030 and 2033.
Thank you so much. That's such a comprehensive list of recommendations. And it's nice to really tackle the investment case because you're right. If the household is not going to see the impact on their energy bill, either because they don't own the house or because of some other, you know, hiccup in the system, it's really hard to convince them or to convince their landlord to make the investment. Marion, do you have the same list? Are there one or two of those you would single out as the most important?
I would like to come back to this idea that we need a portfolio of instruments. I think that that's very true. So what will be very important is as member states start designing those policies, we need to take a step back and think about all the different types of people and companies that need to make the investments and what is the barrier that they are facing right now. So there may be different reasons for not doing an investment. And it's good to have this understanding before going into the design of instruments and before deciding what instrument will be most suited to each population. So I would actually add to the list this stock-taking exercise where we really need to understand the needs of people and what challenges they're actually facing right now, because the package comes on top of existing challenges that people are experiencing already every day right now. So we need to have a good understanding of those challenges before moving into the policy design.
We talk about what if the carbon price rises to 250 euros. We've talked about if it hits even 150, that would have a big impact. As we record this here at the end of June, Michael, where do we stand now and why are we expecting changes on such a big scale?
What we are seeing, and then I'd like to link this to what the others have previously said about the choice of instruments. I think we do have a double layer problem. So the first one is, or potentially the second one is the understanding the barrier. So what prevents people from making these investments in the very first place? Because even without climate policy, there are good reason to renovate your building or your house. So that is one thing, but the other thing is really the financial volume that we need. It's a huge sum, and I'm not even sure that we can properly assess it because we have very sparse data that's probably not of good quality, and it might change substantially over time, depending on how scarce building materials become, how high interest rates are, and so on. So we are talking about really, really big money here. And getting this money, I think it's the top level problem. This links us back to the question, where do we stand? So we're now facing the situation where we have a new emission trading system that will, where prices may rise to very high levels.
Rise from what though? Where are we right now?
We are right now in a situation, you mean with respect to the emission trading system?
Yeah, let's see, if we talk about the price of carbon rising to 150 or rising to 250, so where is it today, just for people who don't track this every day?
So the new system that covers the building sector, among others, will only be implemented from 2027 on. So we don't see a price yet. So this is about to come and to be implemented. And the prices we were speaking about are prices that price levels for 2030. So we might see a new system coming on and then price that rises very steeply from basically zero on the first day or whatever it will be up to 150 or up to 250. So that will be an immense rate of price increase. And this only reflects the financial needs or the costs of what we are trying to achieve, and also the urgency and the rapidness and the time scale at which we need to achieve, because this is a substantial challenge. It's not just the order of it. So the large chunk of emissions that we are covering or the state of the building sector, it's also the relatively small time scale, because the way the ETS2 is designed, we want to bring down all emissions in that sector, which are still relatively high, to down to zero in just 15 to 17 years. And so this is what the system reflects.
That's huge. Thank you for walking us through that. The idea that we're going to introduce this carbon price to push people to consume fewer fossil fuels is revolutionary in a lot of ways.
No, indeed it is. Just wanted to add a bit of complexity to what Dr. Pallet was saying, also for our listeners. So there are two things. Of course, the Commission is aware that member states are not moving fast enough to decarbonize the building sector, nor transport for the matter. They introduced with the ETS2 a market stability reserve mechanism that should help a bit contain the price. Then a lot of critics say it's not going to be enough, but maybe we can go into that. I also think it's not going to be enough, probably. But also, you know, if the price spikes to such levels, one wonders if there's going to be the political consensus to keep the mechanism into place, or whether they will walk back on it and dismantle it, which would be tremendous for climate and for European climate ambitions, and also for the rest of the world to see the EU stepping back on its own mechanisms and programs. But the other thing on the more optimist side is that with such high prices, of course, also revenues will increase. by the same amounts, really. So virtually, member states could just compensate one-to-one the increase in price to consumers. Of course, that would completely level off the whole mechanism, right? The price incentive, because if you are charged 100 euros and then you are paid back the same amount, then you don't have the price incentive anymore. So it's going to be really tough for member states to find the right balance there between investment support to do the investments needed, renovations, fuel switching, etc., and the compensation mechanism, especially for the vulnerable households. And they have to submit social climate plans to the European Union on basically detailing how they want to spend the social climate fund money, which is going to be introduced in 2026, thanks to the revenues mostly of the ETS2. It's going to be really important that member states make this social climate plans in a very structured and sensible way, with detailing their plan. And the same is going to go with national long-term renovation plans, which is another type of plans that member states will have to hand into the Commission in 1 year from now, in June 2025.
When we come back, we'll talk more about these challenges and how to move forward. Michael Pala and Marion Santini and Bruegel's Giovanni Scaravati, we're talking about decarbonizing buildings. And we've talked about a lot of things that would help, but now I'd like to hear a little bit more about the challenges. Like, how do we get people to take up this portfolio and to find these vast sums of money? Michael, is there one or two things that you think might be the big challenge to overcome? And do you see a way around it?
There are two challenges. So where do we find the money and how do we get people to use them? And I think in terms of getting people to use them, there are a variety of barriers that Marion already mentioned. But I think ultimately, and this might be too much of an economist angle on the issue, I think a lot of these issues are actually related to how markets work and if markets provide the right services or the right offers or products that we will need for deep renovation. So I think, or acknowledging that we ultimately need to have a lot of markets work to that end, I think we need to use market-based tools and a very high carbon price, even though it's politically demanding and very inconvenient and a burden to low-income households, is probably the one big signal that we need. So we need to make clear to people this will be costly and renovating will pay off, or buying a heat pump. So this must be there, and I think this can change a lot. It's definitely not the whole story, but this is really a big difference because there's a lot of complex decision making and a lot of coordination required. So I think ultimately we need a high enough price. And as Giovanni already mentioned, a high price, if it's not too high, that means high endangering political acceptability, will also mean getting more revenues from selling the allowances in this system. That would also mean, or by extension mean, that we would have more public finance. And to use this public finance in a smart way to leverage private finance, I think this is the main thing we need to look out for. And at the same time, we need to acknowledge that public finance will be limited. So the amounts that we need are really huge. So we need to make sure we use this money cost effectively from a social point of view. And this is something I think that is still under acknowledged, that even though it's generally right that we can have the highest impact with worst performing buildings, we also need to make clear what is the right level of renovation, how deep we really want to go. And this can be a bottomless pit. I mean, we can bring every worst performing building to a top efficiency standard, but from my point of view, we need to choose wisely. And that means we just need to make investments on renovation that is sufficient enough to make installing a heat pump in these buildings efficient. Because I think using the route through decarbonizing the energy supply rather than making big renovations that might be very costly is much more promising in terms of overall cost effectiveness.
Marion?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's important to remember that the price signal is effective as long as people can respond to it. So I think while a price signal is being introduced, you need all those policies that will come with it and that can facilitate the emergence of a, for example, the emergence of a business offer for the installations we need to make. So there needs to be a right balance between the pricing policies and other policies that will be needed. I think, as you said, there is this question of what kind of buildings we target and what kind of interventions we want to have on each building. And I think here again, policies will be very helpful to bring the right level of information to buildings owners to help them understand what kind of investments make them from their side. And what's interesting is that you can't have one of these policy without the other. So you need to have a good understanding of the building. You need to have the price signal. You need to have market functioning well. You need to have the right level of subsidies for those who need it. In some cases, you need up to 100% subsidy because in some cases, the investments will not happen unless there is this very high level of subsidy. So I think it's really not easy puzzle to solve. And as my colleagues were saying, the member states have to prepare the social climate plans in now a year time. And it will be very important to consult with local groups, to consult with civil society, businesses, to really have a full picture of what we need to do right now to accelerate what is already happening right now. So there is a lot of policies we can build up, but now we really need to accelerate.
Fanny, where do you want to leave people with this? Should they be hopeful?
Yeah, good question. I think they should. However, it's really important the implementation in single countries. We have seen instances of backlash, I'm thinking like in Germany, after the announcement of the fossil fuel boilers ban, or we have seen, you know, policies like in Italy with the super bonus that are not really fiscally sustainable. So now is the time to take stock of what happened so far and design better policies. If national governments manage to do so, then we are not going to see the price shock mentioned over and over in this podcast. We are not going to have the massive impact on households, especially vulnerable households. And at the end of it, we're also going to have cheaper energy bills, cleaner air, which is going to result also into a positive impact on public finances because of healthcare, more productivity also, and overall also more expensive buildings because also the property value is going to increase after this type of interventions. So the payoff is massive. We just really need the right set of policies.
Michael, closing thoughts?
Essentially, I can only concur. So I think what we need to acknowledge is that we are not, I mean, we often talk about climate policy in terms of plans. I think we need to talk about it in terms of experimentation. The challenges are so huge, and the way we are dealing with buildings in the past have been mainly driven by energy efficiency considerations, and that were rather marginal. I think moving forward, we have so much more to accomplish, and this should be thought of experimentation, given what we want to achieve in such a small time scale. And I think it will be most fascinating to see how Europe will deal with that, how new policy innovations, social innovations come up, and I hope there will be plenty. And then we need to take it from there.
Mario?
Well, I think when we're reading Giovanni's paper and looking at all the examples of policies that are actually working and that actually help people overcome the barriers, we can be hopeful. Now we need to be aware that there is something we cannot afford, is that some people, vulnerable households, remain reliant on fossil fuel while the rest of the economy is decarbonizing. So we need to keep that in mind when we're designing those policies, and I think it's possible.
Thank you so much. This report that we've been talking about will be available at Bruegel.org on our website, along with an event with the same speakers you heard today and a couple others. You can find all of our archives on our website, Bruegel.org. I'm here today with Michael Pala, Mario Santini, Giovanni Scaravati. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sound of Economics. Hope to see you next time.